Joseph Papp is perhaps the most powerful man in the American theater today. 20 years ago, this product of the Brooklyn streets introduced free performances of Shakespeare to the parks of New York. Today, in addition to his summer theater in Central Park, Joe Papp presides over 5 off-Broadway theaters and has lately added 2 prestigious theaters in Lincoln Center. And just to prove a do-gooder can make it in the marketplace, he moved a pair of his plays, Two Gentlemen of Verona and That Championship Season, onto Broadway. Not only were they commercially successful, they both won Tony Awards. More recently, he's turned his talent to television with the successful play with music, Much Ado About Nothing, and the highly controversial play, Sticks and Bones. Mr. Papp, you're almost as well known as a fundraiser as a producer and a director in the theater. And I've been told that you've raised over $1 million a year for the last 10 years, and I suspect in the last year, probably more than that. I know you don't like begging for money. How should the theater be supported? What is the proper way in which to support a theater?
Did you say I was a fundraiser?
Fundraiser, yes. No, I'd never heard of it as a fundraiser.
I've been accused of that. How should a theater be supported? Yeah. The ideal way is through the box office.
It should be self-supporting then,
The ideal way. Yes, if it could be self-supporting, that would be the best way to operate a theater.
If it could be.
Yes, but it's not possible if you're interested in some kind of continuity. Mm. If you're interested in merely in having a show run or make it, the best place for you to go is to the commercial theater, if you can raise the amount of money necessary to produce a play, and take a gamble on a hit. And then there's nothing more, there's nothing clearer than a hit, which means that people want to see this product, and they pay for it at the box office.
Sure.
There's no ideology involved, there's no question of support by governments and so forth. It's a straight transaction in the same way you'd buy groceries or petroleum.
But you're interested in producing more than hits, aren't you?
Well, I'm interested in producing plays, per se. I'm interested in the theater, the art of the theater, which is not the same as producing, putting on plays.
What distinction do you make then?
Well, the basic distinction, I think, lies in my interest in the growth of young talent, in the development of plays. It's like, rather than buying an orchard sort of straight out, I like to plant seeds and see them grow. And also, when I do produce a play, which is like cutting the tree down in a certain sense, I like to replenish it. Mm. I mean, I have a sense of the past in the theater, what it has done, and what the function of a writer is today in our society, the meaning of the
That's what you mean by continuity, then, whereas the simple performance completed finishes the process. But with what you're doing, the process continues because it is a process of growth.
Well, if I carry this parallel a little further, when the tree starts to bear fruit, you want that fruit to be consumed some way and properly distributed. And again, here the difference is also that I feel that more people should partake of that fruit than just merely those who have the money, or those who just have a particular interest in the theater as a form of entertainment.
You grew up without money. You grew up, in fact, you've been quoted as saying you grew up surrounded by terror. Grew up in Brooklyn, as a matter of fact.
Well, yes, I was raised in very poor. Poor circumstances.
Your father was unemployed during
most
the Depression.
Of the time.
So that having drama available, freer at
There was
small
drama
cost.
Available during the Depression. There was no problem about that.
But yet you said that...
I'm not talking about drama on the stage. I'm talking about drama
different kind
in
of
life.
Drama.
Yes.
What kind
it's
of drama? What kind of drama did you grow up
well,
with?
Well, anybody who's lived in the ghetto knows what that is. It's that sort of drama. I didn't know it as drama at the time. I thought it was just, that was life. Later on, I began to understand this was also drama as well as life.
You've said in some context that music and dancing were a part of that kind of life, but the drama in the more formal sense was not. I didn't quite understand why music and dancing were a part of it. Drama is easy to understand. It was beyond you, as you've said, because of the cost. But was music and dancing easily available, or are you talking about music and dancing at dinner, again in a different context?
I mean in the very essence of it. Music, singing, dancing on the street,
Your father was interested in music.
He liked to sing. He was a good, he was a fine singer. Mm. We used to sing together. When I say the very, the beginnings of the theater, so-called, are usually, is in the home or in church or in synagogue, a place where you sing or where there's a ritual. And dancing, we dance in the street all the time. Mm-hmm. There's always street dancing. I mean, you just travel around any of the large cities. And particularly amongst minorities, there's constant dancing and singing. Mm-hmm. It's the basic rhythm of life.
Yes.
And when it's transformed into, let's say, on a, in some cases, not to a higher sphere, but in certain, then you have the essences where artists take what is basic to our rhythms and put them into other kinds of forms. And that requires a certain kind of artistry. What the kind of dancing and singing I'm talking about just requires that you be alive and happy.
Yes. Which, under those circumstances, was in itself something of an achievement, I suppose.
That it was an achievement, an interesting achievement, I think.
Did, were you at all interested at that period of your life in the more formal sense of music, dance, theater, or...?
Well, I had no idea that there was a formal theater. I didn't know the theater existed.
You had no reason to know that, would you?
No, I had no reason. First of all, there was no theater in the area in which I lived. There was... But there were records available occasionally, certain classical records, mm-hmm. which we stumbled across. I had early, they were early in my family, there were Caruso records that had been found, not purchased, mind you. And somebody went out of business or somebody gave up an apartment and kind of stack of records which had both Caruso as well as early jazz, and became very interested in jazz at that time, too. Plus the kind of music that existed in the time, which is mostly a kind of a jazz, but at that time, the early jazz was being changed and becoming a little more formalized into swing.
Yeah.
That thing. But I knew nothing about the theater at all. In fact, it wasn't until after I'd really gotten out of the Navy, I was 22 years old, and I discovered that there was such a thing as a theater.
You did do a little theater in the Navy, but you said you had only a passing interest.
Well, it wasn't theater. It wasn't, I mean, theater, I would, anybody that was interested in the play was, you know, was a straight. I mean, that sort of person was a square kind of person. I was interested mostly in music, dancing, vaudeville.
And your formal education ended at high school, didn't it?
Yes. I stopped in high school.
Rather unusual for someone who is so deeply involved and such a pivotal figure in the arts here in New York City.
Well, the arts have nothing to do with formal education.
That's right.
They have no connection.
It's an important point,
I think. And sometimes it has the opposite effect on the arts.
Really?
Yes. Mm. The arts have to do with, first of all, with an emotional sense of yourself and the world, a certain creative attitude, a certain imaginative notion about things, people, mainly. Essentially, what you do is you learn your craft after a while. I did a lot of reading afterward and became an expert on the Elizabethan period, in fact.
This is after you left the Navy.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I went to the West Coast and became involved with a theater there because only I was sort of interested in acting at the time.
You were interested in acting at that point.
Yes, mm-hmm. I acted somewhat, and but mainly I became interested in directing and did a lot of that. But that was all new to me. In fact, the first book I'd ever read was a book called... Masters of the Drama, John Gassner. Mm-hmm. I later received a degree in his name at some point, at some doctorate. I read the book. It was from Aeschylus to O'Neill at the time. Mm-hmm. This is, I think he added Arthur Miller after that. Mm-hmm. But I began to suddenly realize there was a whole tradition in the theater. It went back to the Greeks and so forth, and that there were writers of various kinds which I had no familiarity. Mm-hmm. And I just began to read, and I just educated myself over several years in this area.
But I saw some reference to your first part as being in Death of a Salesman, and coming about because of some confusion that you were someone's nephew. I didn't quite understand.
Oh, that's an interesting story.
Is it a true story?
Yes, I think I got the part because the stage manager did believe that I was the nephew of the producer. For some reason, it seemed that someone I had known in New York had mentioned my name. He had been in the office of the producer, I'll mention his name, Kermit Bloomgarden, a very distinguished producer, plays, did most of Arthur Miller's plays. And I didn't realize that, why I had gotten this role, because first of all, the role required someone very, very big and strong and looking like an athlete, and I was short and not the right size. Also, I had no experience, really, whatsoever, very little. And I was kind of amazed at the kind of treatment I was being given. Everybody was sort of so polite to me, very charming, teaching me everything about Lico's and... began to learn all about lighting and so forth at the time. And halfway through, they said, how's your uncle getting along? I said, my uncle? Kermit, how's Kermit doing? Well, I suddenly discovered in that moment that they had assumed I was a nephew of this man. Mm. I never tried to tell them otherwise. I thought I may as well.
That's something you do learn in Brooklyn, I suppose.
I may as well stay with it. Well, it would be foolish to. I'd want to destroy their illusions, yes, you know. I read O'Neill say, I believe illusions should be maintained at all costs. And so I didn't discourage anybody or let them think otherwise.
You went very quickly into directing, didn't you?
Yes, even when I was on the road with that show, yeah. I began to direct.
When did you stage the O'Casey?
Oh, that was plays. My first fiasco. I did.
Was that here in New York?
Yes, in New York at a they call it American Yugoslav Hall, which was later condemned by the Un-American Committee as a hotbed for subversives, mostly Yugoslavians, you know. And I produced that, directed two of the plays, had someone else direct another. And I made the unfortunate mistake at that time to use many blacks in the company.
Why was it a mistake?
Well, it was a mistake from a viewpoint of the critic, Brooks Atkinson, who was a great admirer of Shona O'Casey. Incidentally, Brooks and I are very good friends. Mm-hmm. And after seeing that production, he said, whoever this chap is, he mentioned my name, he should certainly think about getting out of the theater. He has no place in the theater. He's obviously destroyed a great writer. I corresponded with O'Casey, and I was very close to the Irish writers. My first really interest was in Irish writers. It was Singh and Yeats and O'Casey.
Your own background obviously is not Irish at all.
No, not at all. I'm Jewish background. Mm-hmm. But we have something in common, I think. Maybe it's the Irish mother has something in common. I don't know, somewhere along the line. Mm-hmm. But I met Sarah Olgood, who was the woman, great actress of the Abbey Theatre, who played Juno and the Peacock, the original production. And I saw that production, not the original, but a production that was later done in California. And I certainly admired it. But I admired the poetry of the Irish writers. And later, I think it was a very natural jump to go to Shakespeare.
Yeah, and that was the jump you made at that point because you wanted a theater of your own.
Well, the idea of continuity, going back to the first question you asked me, I don't like to be in the supermarket business of turning out products. Some way the work I do must have some relationship to my life and to society. So the theater itself always represents that view, my theater.
So you formed a small theater group on the Lower East Side.
Well, that was when I became interested in the classics primarily. Mm-hmm. We called it the Elizabethan Theater Workshop, and I did some Marlowe, did Edward II, and juxtaposed Shakespeare's Richard II, and I began to deal with a young company. These are pretty well-known actors now, but at that time they were unemployed.
Yeah.
Began to use black actors only because there were many black actors available, and they weren't being employed, and very talented ones. Roscoe Lee Brown was one of the early actors with his company. And we did a lot of Shakespeare, mostly in contemporary dress, because we didn't have any money for anything. And
that's why it was in contemporary dress, then.
Yes, we borrowed the clothes, and I guess we stole some from various places. We had people working in department stores, and we got various things. I don't want to talk about the ethics of the occasion, but I think these people were glad they supported us, even though they didn't know it at the time. In fact, CBS was a major support when I began to work for CBS as a stage manager, and they provided us with lots of lamps and cable and various other
instruments. And didn't know it.
Well, they didn't know it, but it was good for them, because after what we signed a contract later on, and I paid off for them in some way, I would think.
Shakespeare in the Park came out of this project, then, didn't it?
Came out of the East 6th Street project, which was on a church on the Lower East Side, the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church. And we moved from there to the out-of-doors. There was a place on Grand Street and East River Drive, which was built during the WPA Federal Theater days. It's an outdoor amphitheater seating roughly 2,000 people. And I saw the place, and I fell in love with it. It's right on the river. The Navy Yard was immediately across the way. And we'd hear, now hear this, now hear this, in the middle of performances. But we took it over, even though it was a very, very disreputable area. They'd had lots of violence there, and we were warned about bringing Shakespeare to that area. The Lower East Side Neighborhood Association said there'd been a stabbing just the night before, and that it'd be foolish to try to, particularly Shakespeare, if we were going to do, had some music or dancing, it might be better. Mm. But we had Shakespeare, very successful there, packed the place all the time. And it started there. Then we moved to Central Park. I developed a mobile unit that began to tour the city. Then it was pulled by a garbage truck, incidentally. Then it fell apart. And it wasn't until several years later, after we had become ensconced there in Central Park, that I developed a very more sophisticated mobile unit, which is still in operation, which is a series of platform trailers, 45 feet, with automatic lighting controls and so forth and so on. And we play throughout the city in various neighborhoods.
And, of course, finally, the theater was built in Central Park.
The Delacorte Theater in Central Park.
And that's been, 17, 18 years now that you've played in Central, played in the parks. Began in...
I think it's less than that.
It's been
It's
had continuity.
Yes, it's been going on for a number of years.
Yes, indeed.
We've done almost all the plays of Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the prime requisites that you set down for this was it to be free. But in 19, was it several years later when you had, when the Commissioner of Parks, Robert Moses, a very powerful man, before you were a powerful man, had a kind of David and Goliath fight over whether it shall or shall not be free.
Was he David and I Goliath or what?
I never really quite understood because things certainly have changed now. He insisted that you charge admission.
Yeah, he was quite an extraordinary man. But he insisted on an admission charge and tried to get us out. It was a major fight and went on for months. The mayor was involved and everybody else. And finally, we took it to court.
You took it to court, Shakespeare Festival.
I did. We were nothing like. Yeah. We were just like two people. And we got a law firm to handle the suit without any charge. It was the Wharton Rifkin Garrison firm. Still our lawyers have been fine.
And you won it.
We won it in the court. We were the last item on the calendar of the year. And we won it 5-0. It was the Court of Appeals. We had lost in lower courts. There was some judge, I think a friend of the mayor's, who turned us down and while he quoted Shakespeare. That was insult to injury. And then we finally got it on the calendar. First they said, well, we don't know if we can get it on the calendar. I spoke to the Chief Justice there at the time and they finally got it on and said that the Parks Commissioner was arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable. And they couldn't impose the edict on him. They just had to suggest that it was the proper thing to do. So he immediately insisted that $20,000 be raised to improve the area. He kept claiming, for some reason or other, that the Shakespeare audiences were trampling the grass. So there were a lot of patriotic people that kept sending him huge bags of grass seed and kept getting it at the Arsenal, which is the Parks Department headquarters. Mm. Anyway, he's no longer Parks Commissioner, and I've been through four Parks Commissioners since him.
Yeah.
But he was quite a tyrannical man, a very, very brilliant man in many respects. His achievements are monumental. People say he created monuments mostly, and he's responsible for a lot of the highways and the byways. Yeah. He was the chairman or the head of about five or six separate agencies, city agencies.
I want to turn your attention to the Public Theater, which you then created after the Shakespeare, not because, as you say, there was a surfeit of Shakespeare, but you wanted to turn to contemporary.
Right. I was always interested in contemporary theater, but Shakespeare is... in a funny way, he's an extraordinary man, and the richness of his works makes demands on actors, directors, and anybody working in the theater has no better teacher. And you can always turn to Shakespeare to understand certain of the problems of the stage. He knew the theater. But my major interest was theater could not survive just on revivals of recreating Shakespeare from the olden days, even no matter how contemporary we produced these plays and how modern they were and how vivid they were and how immediate they were. They were still plays written 400 years ago. And I turned immediately, naturally, to the writer, the contemporary writer, the man who's writing today.
And built a writer's theater.
Actually, it is more a writer's theater than any other kind of theater. And this with all due respect to very fine directors and actors and technicians, designers and so forth. But essentially, I operate from the writer. It's his ideas that I'm interested in. Mm. When I say ideas, I don't necessarily mean someone give you some solution to the petroleum problem, but someone who has a certain kind of insight into our condition. And I'm always interested in that. Mm. I am personally interested in that, so.
You took over an old building in Greenwich Village, the Astor Library.
It was the original, it was the first free public library in New York, but it had been converted into a place for homeless Jews after World War II. And many, many refugees came there. Many, many didn't, that escaped Hitler. Mm-hmm. That was before World War II, Hitler's tyranny. And it was an old building, but it's Italianate Renaissance, quite lovely, but it was in ruin.
You went heavily in debt to reconstruct that into...
$2.5 million worth of debt.
Yeah.
But it's quite a beautiful building, and I'm very happy that that building is preserved because so many of the fine buildings are being destroyed or torn down or left to the waste. I think we made that building viable. The problem with restoration of landmark buildings is that, well, you don't want to make, they're usually made into museums and there's no life in those things. Well, we have five or six theaters operating there all at the same time. Different.
You opened a public theater with Hare, didn't you?
That was the first play we did, Hare. And then I did Hamlet after that, a modern version.
Why Hare? That was a real departure at the time that came on the stage, was it not?
Well, you can never ask the question, why Hare at that time? I mean, I had a choice. I was going to make a transition from Shakespeare. I just thought I'd make a quiet transition. I was going to do an English play, a contemporary writer, a very fine writer who wrote quite skillfully, high literary skill. And I had optioned this play, and I was about to do it, and then I got a twinge. I felt, well, this isn't right for some reason or other. And then I was teaching at Yale at the time, teaching drama there. And on the way back, I don't teach anymore, I give that up, I met Jerry Ragney, who was one of the authors of this thing, and he was in a play or something up then. Yeah, he said he was working on something, and he had five or six scribbled pages, and I looked at it, and I sort of was generally interested in it. So I asked him to write some more and let me see it. And the thing that struck me about the material was that it dealt with the kind of loneliness of young people. And it was at the height of the hippie movement. And I became interested in it. Then I decided one day, I said, I'm not going to do that old play, that English play. I'm doing an American play by American writers now. And we involved Galt McDermott, who's a fine composer, who's now a millionaire, they all are, made a lot of money. But I became interested in that particular feeling. I mean, it happened to coincide with other feelings that existed, and it became quite a success. We made over $1 million on that, on the show, after we had sold it. I sold it to Michael Butler. Because
So the income from the hits have helped pay for the other programs, the development?
Well, in a sense, yes. We're in an interesting position, at least I've selected that position, I pursue it, is that we're part institutional in a sense that we do require constant fundraising to keep the institution going. On the other hand, we'd like to limit that if we could. Hopefully that we can make money in the general marketplace on our material, like getting into contracts with CBS and doing, you know, these particular specials. I'm interested in the commercial world. And going back to the original question, ideally, I would like to have no support from anybody except the audience. But then I would say my audience. When I say my audience, I mean people that would be interested in the kind of plays and shows that I feel are significant.
One of your purposes has been to develop new audiences. Now, is your audience a broad audience or a narrow audience that's interested in the kind of thing that
all
you're
theater,
most interested in?
All theater audiences are narrow audiences.
Are they?
There are no broad theater audiences. Mm-hmm. The broadest theater audience exists on Broadway. In a sense, when they go to see a big musical hit or a star, that's the broadest theater audience you can possibly reach. I'm interested in that audience too. When we did Two Gentlemen of Verona on Broadway, we were getting that kind of people. And I liked it better than downtown, in a sense. It was much broader. On the other hand, downtown at the Public Theater, when we're not playing uptown at Lincoln Center or the Broadway theaters, we do get, for the most part, a more discriminating audience, but in a sense, these audiences are more likely to respond to new works and accept that without feeling that their integrity or something is being threatened.
How will your assumption of responsibility for Lincoln Center affect your desire to reach these new audiences? That one thinks of as kind of established audience that goes to Lincoln Center regularly, identifiable kind of audience.
Yes, I don't know. We have 26,000 subscribers, of which 8,000 are new subscribers, 18,000 are people who have subscribed to Lincoln Center before. We're getting some flack from some of those 18,000. Yeah. I've put on my first production there, which is a play by David Rabe called Boom Boom Room. He's the man who wrote several plays about the war in Vietnam.
Sticks and Bones.
Sticks and Bones was the most
people recognized.
Most people recognized it was done on television, created a great controversy. But this is a very interesting play about a go-go girl. But he's still in Vietnam in a certain sense. In other words, the battlefield is the same metaphor as the Go-Go Hall. And as I thought, it was a fantastic play. And it got the major critics here panned them. Mm-hmm. Panned it. Particularly Clive Barnes, who assaulted the play. He felt
You've
something.
Not had much love of critics, even though you've fared fairly quite well over the years, have you not?
There's a notion somewhere that naturally people in the arts always hate critics. But there's a basis for that. And it's not just a petulant kind of thing about sour grapes. Naturally, everybody loves the critic that praises his work.
Sure.
I've have contempt for some critics that praise work that I've done, which I felt was poor. On the other hand, I feel they fail to recognize some very, very important things. So that it isn't, there are variations within the groups themselves. There's some very fine writers, critics. Harold Klorman is a very fine critic. Jack Kroll of Newsweek is a very fine critic. Ted Kalem sometimes comes out with very, very fine things. The Daily Critics, I've always liked Douglas Watt, who writes for a mass newspaper, even though he didn't like Boom Boom Room, I do respect him. He writes for the Daily News. Clive Barnes is somewhere, there's a pretentiousness there somewhere, that great liberalism and love and so forth, that I have a feeling that that essentially I questioned the integrity of the writing and the viewpoint. Douglas Watts, who writes for the New York Post, is an elderly gentleman. He's barely making it. But occasionally he responds in a very genuine, childlike way. And other times he's totally bewildered by what's going on. Then you have hatchet men like John Simon, who, in a certain sense, I have more respect for than Clive Barnes, even though he's cruel and...
So it has nothing to do with what they say, but how they say it.
That's right. It's a whole attitude. See, we in the theater make their livelihood possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, people are hit. They think they're playing with toys. There are certain writers, and there are actors. Well, there are writers, for example, in particular, whose lives are their writing. I mean, that's where they live, and that's why they write. They're attacked mercilessly sometime, or in some kind of irresponsible way. There's nothing to say that people should not be criticized, that these people don't have a function. Mm-hmm. But I think they lose the sense of what the impact of what they say has on these people. And also, they're backed up by huge newspapers, and so the impact is really very, very poor, and it's destructive, you see. So I don't accept what they say. I demand the same forum. You know, I don't have their space, but I demand the same kind of retaliation that they do to me, and I feel it's only fair.
In the half minute remaining, I want to ask you a difficult question, which I think you can probably answer very simply. Given all this and the responsibility you have in the theater and the kind of thing you were just talking about with respect to critics, do you ever have moments when you wake up and say, is all this really important?
You're assuming I go to sleep when you raise that question.
Maybe you don't.
I always question that.
Do you?
I always question the importance. Every artist does in some way, saying, is what I'm doing really important? And I really don't know. People tell me that more than I really know. The thing itself is not important. It's meaningful to me. Whether it has the same relative importance to others, I don't know. I doubt it, really. And sometimes I say, here we rush to an opening night, and we say everything depends on it. But you know that 99% of the population hasn't the slightest awareness of what's going on this great night.
Thank you very much, Mr. Papp.
You're welcome.